I've enjoyed the study of international relations and diplomatic history, but I feel that's too often done by scholars in the West with attention to traditional sources and traditional matters, high-level diplomacy, memoirs, national security-related documents, and so much more is out there in the study of international relations, in the study of foreign policy, in the study of international history. There are so many different kinds of sources and kinds of materials, whether you're talking about film festivals and newspapers and university student exchange, and there are just all sorts of different kinds of sources that can really be fruitful for the study of international relations, and I would say often more insight than simply studying the traditional material.
That must really provide some amazing insights for researchers and scholars, having the availability to a lot of these archives now and gaining a picture of the relationships that we didn't have before.
I just love that part of my work. I mean, the archival research is very fun. It's very interesting. It's hard work, and sometimes it's very slow, and you kind of wonder about the nature of the progress that you're making. But this kind of work is so exciting, as you say. I mean, there are new opportunities here, new sources. And in the old days, we were just sort of dependent on Pravda, Izvestia, and Renmin Mirbao, the People's Daily in China, or Pravda in the Soviet Union. These were important sources, and of course you can learn a lot from reading those sources and from reading newspapers generally, and people did, we did, but nothing beats being able to combine that sort of knowledge with more exposure to the archives.
At the risk of oversimplifying it, it would seem that the Soviets had wanted to at least make China somewhat in their own image, but did they underestimate the Chinese, and how?
There was an ongoing problem there that was evident in some of the terms that eventually the other bloc parties, and the Chinese in particular, used to describe the Soviets. They talked about great power, chauvinism, or even kind of traditional Russian chauvinistic attitudes that were evident among the advisors themselves, who maybe looked at China in a kind of condescending way as a traditional sort of Eastern and backward land that they were trying to enlighten and kind of culturally improve. So all this was very insulting to the Chinese, and they began to talk about these things openly. They began to communicate with the other bloc parties about these things as well, very openly. The Poles and Czechs and East Germans and others in the bloc had concerns as well about the Soviet Union. So the opening of the archives now after 91 and the collapse of the Soviet Union and Chinese archives are comparatively open for the 1950s since about 2006 or so. There's a lot more interesting material that allows us to kind of see these internal debates.
Among those frustrations, was there some venting going along, finger-pointing, that sort of thing?
That's right, yeah. And then the Russians, in turn, as things started to go bad, were increasingly blaming the Chinese for being manipulative, for being lazy, for not performing the tasks that they were supposed to perform. And then, of course, a lot of this had to do with the nature of the socialist planned economy. A lot of the tension is also connected to just simply the nature of socialism. This whole Soviet system was generating all sorts of tension in the Soviet Union itself, too. So it's not all intercultural, and then it's mixed with the whole problem of Soviet socialism.
As the Chinese continued to push the specific Chinese experience, I wonder if that had an impact on some of the other members of the Soviet bloc and eventually helped to hasten the fall of the Soviet Union, the breakup.
I think that's definitely part of the long-term picture. You know, in the short term, the East and Central European parties are not going to side with the Chinese. I mean, there's nothing there for them, especially in the vision of the Great Leap Forward as it's unfolding from 58 to 60, and there's, after all, a big famine and a huge famine in China in 61. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in the longer term, globally, this is huge. This fragmentation within the socialist world, the consequences here are enormous, and then it becomes obvious later. By the late 1960s, you have direct military conflict on the Sino-Soviet border in March of 1969, and then by the early 1970s, with the normalization which is happening with Europe in the 60s, and then eventually with America in the early 70s. These are crucial moments in the whole overall collapse of the socialist world, and I would go right back to the Sino-Soviet split as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, events in the history of socialism or the history of the Cold War.
We do like to learn from history to try to get a sense of where things might go in the future. How would you categorize the state of Sino-Russian relations at this point? And is it a matter of what the Russians can learn from the Chinese now?
That is an interesting transformation here. Things have really changed. I mean, if the common slogan in the 1950s was the importance of learning from the Soviet Union, it was a ubiquitous Chinese slogan. That's absurd now. You're right. We can't imagine a sort of public campaign of that sort today. Whereas, what can the Russians learn from the Chinese? That's an interesting question. They can learn a lot, obviously, like we all can. But the problem is, I think, from the Russian perspective, that there is still remains a kind of disbelief that an Eastern society, part of Asia, could be so much more productive and better off than them. That history, I think, is difficult for Russia to overcome when now, as you say, the relationship has been reversed. And if anything, there's more for Russia to learn from China than there is for China to learn from Russia. Unfortunately, I think the main part of the exchange today concerns energy, concerns oil and natural gas, and the Russians as the primary producers and sellers of significant quantities of oil to a China that now is proving to have this relentless need for energy resources.